And we are live. We are live. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Benzinga Cannabis Insider. My name is Javier Casas. I'll be your host today. We don't have Elliot with us, but he will be back very soon. I hope you don't get bored of my face. We'll be talking about cannabis, stocks, business, news. We have three amazing guests today, or guest columnist Morgan Paxia, and two other great guests you have to stick around to find out. But let's get this started. Let's roll the intro. That's what's up. We're ready. Look at my themed shirt. Drop in the comments if you like the shirt. And by the way, do you know that the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference is coming back to Chicago September 27th and 28th at the Magnificent Mile, Marriott Magnificent Mile, bzcannabis.com for more details. Come join us. I am 100% confident that you will not regret it. This is the place where deals happen, where business happens. Top executives, Governor Pritzker, the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, all the top CEOs, publicly traded companies, private companies, all of the top investors, among which is none other than our good friends at Poseidon, who will be joining us right now for a weekly column with Morgan Paxia. Let's bring Morgan Paxia of Poseidon on to Benzinga Cannabis Insider.
I feel like the price is right where I get to run on down.
we're focused now. I'm all over the place. I just finished interviewing Method Man. Are you into rap at all?
A little bit. My wife is more than I am, so she keeps me honest there. But yeah.
What's your preferred genre of music?
Ooh, a lot of reggae. You know, when I went and right down the street from us where I lived off campus was this awesome beach bar called the Ocean Mist, and just a legendary reggae beach bar where some of like the most iconic reggae bands of, you know, for all time came through there at one point or another. And so great spot and a lot of music action there. So it's spent a lot of time in college listening to it and still do today.
Do you think, you know, your connection with reggae music influenced your love of cannabis at all? Did it generate it in any way, or are these two like separate things?
You know, it's a great question. I think earlier on, I don't know how much of the connection was there, but as time has gone on, certainly feel like there's much more connection as I've learned more about it and understand more, you know. Because early on, when you're a kid, you're just kind of like, this is great, this is fun. But as you understand more about the culture and everything behind it, it gives it a lot more meaning. So it's very cool. Love your t-shirt, by the way.
Thanks. What's your take on celebrity cannabis brands, right? Like, for instance, you know, Method Man has Tikal, and like Rohan Marley, Bob Marley's son, has Lion Order. I dropped a great feature on Forbes today. You can check it out after the show, by the way. But like, how do you feel? Do you feel they work? They don't work? Somewhere in the middle? It depends. What's your take on this topic?
It's yeah. I mean, I think the clearest differentiation between success and not is if the celebrity is only looking to profit, putting skin in the game. They're trying to build a brand, and they're putting in the work. Much different situation because, you know, cannabis is as we all know, you know, operating businesses, generating profit is hard enough. And if you're taking 12.5% off the top, the brand's going to die. It's almost certainty. So if there is a better alignment between the celebrity and the brand and the operation, actually understanding what their role is and how they can participate with, in a fundamental way that creates value, that doesn't take value, then much different strategy. I mean, if you look at, there's countless celebrity brands that have tried to launch in cannabis and CBD, Mm-hmm. Very few of them have been successful. And I think that's, you could point to that. I mean, just even going back to, you know, talking about Bob Marley, look at Marley Naturals initially with Tilray back in the day, you know, and that family, right, is still trying to come after them for like, what is it, $30 million or something that in unpaid mm-hmm. royalties. And so.
You have three items for us today. Do you want to dive in? Your pick on where you want to start.
I'm going to do a little bit of an audible because I was on Benzinga Cannabis website today while before the show, and Viridian's chart of the week I thought mm-hmm. was an interesting one to call out for anyone that's you know, online right now. Check out that chart. It's from Viridian talking about the Q2 estimates and talking about how companies are trying to get analyst estimates down. And saying, even using the word forcefully. And I was looking at that, and then I was also reflecting on Jess Beto's at Water Tower Research. He tweeted yesterday that, I mean, this is for the first time in a long time, the top six MSOs, you know, if you took a basket of them, they beat revenue consensus by 1% and adjusted EBITDA by 6.7%. And I really don't remember last time MSOs as a cohort were beating estimates. And so I'm a big fan of UPOD, under promise, over deliver. It's something I've been pounding the table on for quarters now, quarters and quarters, that it just sets up for this position of disappointment. And so I understand these companies' interest in trying to get the analysts to listen to them and get numbers down. And I feel like for a long time they were not listening, and they were keeping these overly optimistic estimates that were just setting up, you know, companies to under, you know, to be a disappointment. So I think forceful is an okay term. I think there's actually some good intention behind it, so that we can be in a process of beating on a really good thing. So I was just, those two things were in my mind and in context of some of the other things I shared this morning. So any thoughts on that?
I have a question for you, right, as an investor, right, that you invest in many, many companies. And I remember, you know, what you said, you know, you're a big fan of under-promising and over-delivering, which I love. But is this something that changed over time with cannabis? And here's why I'm asking. I remember maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was working on a pitch deck for my company, El Planteo. And I was chatting with Emily, your sister, your partner in business and crime, legality now, in Tahira. And one of the things they said was, you know, like, be optimistic in your pitch deck. I want to see also like the best case scenario here. Don't be so conservative in your revenue estimates. They had like a growth curve that was like, you know, where's that balance, right, between reflecting the potential and the optimism and not over promising?
Great question. So when companies get to a certain size and they're in the public domain, they're measured every day, right, because they are publicly traded securities. So that's a very different investor base, or typically. Historically, I mean, we play the whole spectrum. But when we're looking at private companies, we put on our venture hat, and we want to see venture-like returns. And so venture-like returns, I mean, you're trying to hit a 10x return. So if you're only growing at a very modest rate, how do you generate a 10x return? So we want to see mm-hmm. the potential of what it could look like. Obviously, we have plenty of data to see how that actually tracks. So if it's centered in reality or if it's not, kind of follow the arc of a company. When it starts out, it's young, it's private, it should have high growth until it's become a much more matured, scaled business, and then that growth slows mm-hmm. down, and then that looks a very different situation. But so it's, you know, you got to think about the entire life cycle of a company, from its formation through to a public company.
Love that. We got time for one more. So you got to pick between DeSantis and the NPR story about psychoactive hemp products. Which one do you want to go for?
I'm gonna pick DeSantis. I think it is important. I think he's a high probability of a Republican potential nominee, right? And as we get into the fall and as election cycle heats up more and more and there's more and more chatter, I do think it's important for voters, for consumers to understand what their candidates could be representing. And if he is one that has a higher probability of being a Republican nominee, it's important to understand that he is not bullish on cannabis as a legal industry. He's using information that is not data-based. He's just kind of pulling some rhetoric that is unsupported. And so there's a great article in Marijuana Moment, as usual, talking about his position on this. And it is something that we really need to be, if there's any way to get to his team and trying to help educate them, because, you know, we all want to see federal reform. And if we have Republicans that are continuing to stay stuck with undated or or completely biased views, that's not helping our industry. So I thought that out today, given his position in this potential presidential cycle.
Yeah, I mean, and what he said is not false, right? And it's not wrong when he said, like, Colorado's illicit market is bigger and more lucrative. But that is also, there's this book that I love by Alfred Hirschman called The Rhetorics of Reaction. And there have been throughout history three key arguments that these conservatives, people who oppose change, have used. And this reminds me very much of this, like the futility of change, right? Like, because we haven't seen the illicit market, disappear, this is pointless. What would you respond to that? Like, what is your take on this?
Oh, well, my take is, I think there is data supporting that for residents of Colorado. I think it even quoted in that article, something like 99% of legal consumers are buying legally. So if you're talking about those that are participating in a legal market, that part of the system is functioning. I think activity like we see here in California, part of that is just long-term culture. But I think it's also because we're still state by state. And as this industry matures, that linkage starts to break down, right? Like, California is exporting a ton of cannabis to New York State because there's no enforcement of it. So, is that who's really to be, everyone always wants to point the finger at somebody. I think this is just, it's a messy process when you transition from unregulated illicit to regulated, and our measurement period is still very short. There's plenty of evidence showing that it is functioning, but there's more time that's needed.
Yeah, we haven't reached a critical mass for the sample size to be quite there just yet. Morgan Paxia, yeah. Managing Partner at Poseidon. We'll see you again next Tuesday at Benzinga Cannabis Insider, 1 p.m. Eastern. What is it, like 10 a.m. Pacific?
10 a.m. Pacific.
And we hope to see you in Chicago at the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Peace. See you. Well, let's keep this clipping because we have a very loaded show. A lot of guests. Next up is Robert Beasley. He's a CEO at Fluent. New CEO. Malia? Robert, welcome to Benzinga Cannabis Insider. How are you doing?
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, great to have you. And congrats on the new position. Tell us all about it. Tell us a little bit about you, your story, your backstory, and a little bit about Fluent and Consortium.
You know, you said it was a new position. I've been in the seat since September of 20. So in cannabis years, that's about seven dogs' lives.
I got to be very honest. I mixed it with Fluent, the lighting company that used to be owned by Osram that has a new CEO this week.
Yes, Fluent does. I became the consultant for Fluent, which is under the ticker name Consortium on the exchange, in January of 20, and then the CEO in September of 20. And at that time, we started a turnaround of the company, which was in a very typical shape of companies in that time period that was as I describe it, it was 100 miles wide and 1 inch deep. It had obtained licenses throughout the United States and various states, and had gone really horizontal with that effort in the race for licenses, and then just ran out of capital to be able to develop those licenses. And so what I did was come in and implement a kind of a grow by contraction strategy, where we cut off a few dead ends and rabbit trails and so forth, and focused at the time on our primary possible moneymaker, which was the Florida market. And we doubled down in Florida. We cut off Puerto Rico and eventually Michigan and some of the others, and focused on Florida, retained Texas, because Texas, we're one of three licensees in Texas, and it represented then and does now a tremendous amount of potential. And we've maintained our stores in Pennsylvania. And so with that base, we've rebuilt. We are the fastest growing cannabis company in Florida. We went from number 14 to number 6. We've thrown up record revenues quarter after quarter, so we're very proud of where we've made it to.
Why are you so bullish in Florida, and why do you choose to leave states like Michigan or territories like Puerto Rico? Like, what differentiates them, or what makes them the right fit for a consortium? Right, because they're like, all these are definitely great markets.
I think that, you know, cannabis being new to a state. New to the country, really, still, if you think about it from a business perspective, they're all in an evolutionary stage, and it's the right fit for your company in the right stage. For us, as I said, when I first came to Fluent, we have several licenses in several states and no dollars. And so we had to figure out how to take our rare, precious dollars and invest them to get the highest return on that investment. And Florida at the time, we're talking 2020, Fluent was a first mover. It was an original licensee in Florida, so it had a good footprint, not a great footprint, but a good footprint. And Florida had the most growth potential. Now, since then, Florida, a lot of the big competitors have come into Florida. There's talk of additional licenses. And so Florida may eventually suffer from the market saturation that you see out west in California, Colorado, and so forth. But at the time, Florida represented our biggest play. Why not Michigan? Michigan, I gave it a good chance. Michigan is a good example that when you're in a highly regulated industry, you are an industry partner with your regulators. And if they're not doing their job, you can't do yours. Michigan, the MRA agency there, just refused to address the import of illegal products. And so we would have, Michigan's an outdoor harvest state. And so we would have a harvest in October, Croptober. We had an anticipated, I mean, you could do the math, number of acres under production, anticipated production, you know what your market yield should be. And it was 10, 20 times that, because lo and behold, 60 something million mysterious milligrams came in from California with no one paying attention to it. And so supply and demand takes over. We have a product we put in the ground anticipating a certain return. By the time we harvest, that return was, you know, the rug was pulled out from under us because the market pricing went down due to illegal imports. And we did it 2 years in a row. And, you know, if you keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result, I think that's called insanity. And so we pulled out. And when Michigan gets its act together, we'd love to be back. But that regulatory agency is going to have to step it up.
You know, we had news this week about, like, for instance, Planet 13 doubling down a little bit in Florida, right? In defiance of other dominant players as well. Like, how do you size up against some of these other very large companies trying to get a piece of the Florida market, which is so highly competitive?
You know, we continue to hear threats from California over the last couple of years. Now it's Planet 13 from out west this way. Previously it was Cookies. All people could talk about 2 years ago was Cookies is coming. And they've had an absolute failure to launch in Florida. Jungle Boys was coming. We were all going to roll up shop and go home.
Yeah.
Almost nothing. It is a very difficult translation from the West Coast to the East Coast. The environmental factors are different. The economic factors are different. The population is different. The fact is Florida is not California in any respect. And so you can't employ the same business strategies, can't grow the same plants, can't use the same techniques. It's different. And adjusting for those differences takes time. Now, you know, with enough capital and enough economic support, they will catch. They're smart people and they'll learn. But it wasn't an instant translation. And so Planet 13's unique. They came out of the retail side. They desperately needed to pick up and get a little deeper in retail in Florida. Opening stores organically is a slow process. And so the move they did recently that was just announced, I think was very smart for them. The strongest part of VitaCann was its retail footprint. And they were, you know, instantly picking up. Last my count was 26 stores. I'm not sure where VitaCann was at the time of the transaction. But it's a good map pickup. And the VitaCann store location model early on, because they were in first mover also, they've got good stores. They've got good location, good stores. And so if the transaction's consummated, and I say that if because I've become wary of that, right? We all read the press on the deal and then later find out the deal didn't happen. And so the press sometimes is a little too far in advance of the actual practicality of doing the deal. So if it happens, it'll be a pretty good pickup for Planet 13.
Again, you know, you being a Floridian, we were just discussing with Morgan a little bit of DeSantis' take on legalization and talking about Colorado and the illicit market still thriving. And you have been involved in advocacy for at least, that I know of, 7 years, maybe eight, maybe more.
Right.
What would you tell DeSantis, right? Like a fellow Floridian, like, dude, you know, Floridian to Floridian.
So, you know, I voted for Ron DeSantis as governor. I was a supporter of him originally. At the time, I had zero connectivity to cannabis and from an operational point of view, simply was from a political point of view and financing. You know, he's all things that happen in the next year and a half have to be judged in light of what it takes to get secure the office of the president. And so if you want to know what Ron DeSantis is going to do, ask what does he need to do to get the presidency, because that's the track he's on. He has not been a supporter of cannabis. He has all the cannabis program he wants. The day the amendment passed, he did a press conference, and I think he called it a cartel. And so, you know, the Department of Health, which is his executive agency, has been super conservative. And almost to the point where they're failing to follow the statute. I was part of a series of applicants that filed some litigation that went to the Supreme Court called the Floridgrown litigation, which criticized the department for just not acting, not doing what the legislative intent was. And they were successful in resisting that. We lost those cases. The Department of Health is behind schedule. And you have to believe that's because they're an executive and that's what the executive wants. Now, why he does not embrace the program, why he doesn't want the program to grow, I think it may not be that he's against cannabis. It may be he has all the cannabis he needs to say that he has cannabis and that he was a supporter of it and that his state is a cannabis state. He may even say that one day, but not too much, because he's got to make happy the other supporters, which are fairly rabid anti-drug of any type supporters. Mm-hmm. So Florida's very conservative. We still have a tremendous amount of the right here. You know, this is Trump territory to some degree down there. And so he's got to get those folks on board.
You know, one to close it up is a little bit of a story time, if you will. And then I'm going to put your brain here for a second. In a recent interview, you mentioned the challenges and the enlightened moments of merging legacy cannabis culture with traditional business practice. Can you think of any instances where understanding the legacy culture of cannabis led to a significant change in strategy or operations at Consortium or Fluid?
I can think of quite a few. And in fact, the legacy members of our team have taught me quite a bit. I understand what their deficiencies are, and they all relate to scale. You know, black market cannabis back in the day, very few people achieve scale like we need to achieve now. So if you have a criticism of legacy cannabis, it's the failure to understand scale. Mm-hmm. However, understanding how to sell the product and the consumer is something that corporate doesn't understand, that legacy needs to teach. Best example is I had one of our legacy growers. I took him to dinner one night and he said to me, he said, you know what? He said, I've sold a lot more weed than you have. I said, probably so. He said, I always sold it based on what it looked like and what it smelled like. And you're selling it based on what a COA tells you, the percentages of THC and the percentages of terpenes. And you're selling it off a piece of paper. He said, I never stood on a street corner with a piece of paper and said, look at this COA, see all these great percentages. I had a product and let them look at it and smell it. So I thought about that and I thought, gosh, he's right. And so we immediately went and designed and had implemented these little clear puffer boxes that we put on our counters where we could put the weed of the bud of the day in, and you could look at it with a magnifying glass and you could smell it. And the sales of those, whatever went in that box, was the leading sale of the day.
Nice.
And it was because people understood how to buy by looking and smelling. And
yeah.
We weren't addressing that need. And so we weren't reaching the consumers. It was a dinner conversation. I listened and I thought, gosh, we're doing it all wrong. And so
100%.
How to connect with the consumer on products and materials and quality is something we need to listen to the legacy market on, because they kind of are the consumer also.
Yeah, no, and that is perfect. Honestly, I the first time I went to a legal store in Canada, you know, before there were these gray area stores, and I loved them, like Cafe, I'm going to shout out a few, but like, and then I went to a very legal store, right? When they started popping up the adult use stores, and you can see the cannabis, you can smell the cannabis. It came in a black box. And I found it to be weird and off-putting. Again, it's like, I really didn't know. This is fresh produce almost, right? I would not buy a tomato before seeing it and touching it and knowing if it's ripe enough or as ripe as I like it, for instance.
Right.
So
you wouldn't buy a tomato in a closed plastic jar that you didn't get to look at the tomato until you got home. And that's how we are forced to sell cannabis in Florida. Even though I give you that opportunity to look at a few select strains in the boxes, if you select mm-hmm. something else that I didn't put out for that day, because I can only have a few of those, you're going to get a white container that's sealed, and it's a mystery. And you get home and we hope all of our customers are pleasantly surprised, but in reality, sometimes they're not. And they bring it back. And the first thing they always start with is, I didn't get a chance to look at this. And what they're saying is, I didn't get to make a good, intelligent, informed purchasing decision like I usually do. And they're right. And so we just accept it back and say we're sorry and get them something else.
Robert Beasley is the not-so-new CEO of Consortium. Thank you so much for joining us at Benzinga Cannabis Insider. Apologies for the brief snafu, but this was great. We hope to have you on again very soon.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's keep this clipping. We got one more guest today. He is the CEO of Damn It Financial. His name is Patrick O'Boyle, and let's bring him on.
Hello, Javier. How are you?
Doing great. Learning a lot today. Very enlightening conversations. How are you doing?
Doing great. Loving your shirt. And I'm sorry I'm missing Elliot today, but
let's send him love. I think he sprained his ankle or something.
Oh, geez. Well, it's the Javier show.
Tell us a little bit about you and Damn It Financial, what you do in layman's terms. I know it's complex, so keep it simple for us.
Yep, I'd love to keep it simple. So came into DAMA in February, not from the cannabis market, so it's new to me. Learning every day, and I've learned so much in a short period of time. But come from a background of payments, banking, software development, and deployment. And really, what we do and what we focus on is we're trying to help that mid-size, and especially love the vertical provider out there, the vertically integrated provider, really get to the next stage of operational readiness and provide them that end-to-end systems from banking to seed to sale, point of sale, to wholesale integrated as well with e-commerce and all the data from end-to-end to help in the decisioning process. So we really want to be that one-stop shop, one-stop provider to that mid-market and wrap it all with expert support to help them grow their business.
6 months into this industry, or at least this job, what are some of the main differences you've seen with traditional finance? What are some of the most surprising learnings? And what we tell other people, you know, looking to get into this space, you know, things that they're not expecting or anticipating that they could and should get ahead of?
No, you know, what intrigued me the most coming into this is the thing that shocks me the most is how this entire industry is forced to operate in this microcosm of the universe, right? Everything we're doing is pretty standard business stuff, right? I mean, you could go get a bank account in a normal world. You can go get loans. You can go get a normal system to run your business, like a point of sale. You can get normal consumer payments, and like you're walking into Quick Trip, except in this world, right? Where all of that has to be reinvented, redone, rebuilt, and used in a special way, and then wrap all that with all of the regulatory complexities state to state, that, right, you think you're very successful in one state, you hop to another state, and just as your last guest was saying, it's a completely different story. So anyone getting into this industry needs to understand the regulatory environment and just the complexity of trying to run a business in this environment is truly unique and challenging.
What about working with banks, right? I'm curious on that front. Like, what is that relationship like? What are the challenges? What are the benefits? And what sets, you know, you and Dama apart?
Yeah, no, great question. So we're not a bank, right? We're not holding a bank charter. We're unique in that we don't compete with banks. We partner with them. So we allow them to get into the cannabis market and then provide what I'll call kind of a wrapper of compliance, technology, and customer support around the CRBs that they want to work with, so that we can allow them to benefit from, you know, holding the deposits and being the banker of their cannabis customer, but with Dama doing all of the taking on all the extra workload. So we allow them to mitigate their risk in getting involved in the cannabis industry. Let Dama kind of be the front face of doing all that work. You get to benefit still from being a bank. So I think we're positioning them well for when, you know, when all this becomes more standard.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty of the business for a second here. You know, you recently acquired GrowFlow.
Right?
This is a C2C point of sale system, right? How does this acquisition fit into, you know, Dama's overall strategy? How does it align with the company? What kind of synergies do you see between these two companies getting?
Another good question. As playing that role of bank, even though we're not a bank, we're providing the services to the cannabis businesses, right? One thing I learned in my previous businesses were banks are the trusted advisor, right? They have the ear of the business. No one's better than perhaps their accountant or their lawyer, right? With, you know, providing some guidance and advice. So the way that GrowFlow piece fits is in two ways. One, we've already had to tackle much of the compliance requirements. So taking GrowFlow to different states, well, we've already done a lot of that compliance effort in those states related to our banking side. Secondly, it's touching the transactional data, right? It's dealing with either the cash management side of it, how they're getting the money in the door, which more, you know, we're back to heavy cash again. Not that it ever really got away, but in recent changes, it's back to a lot of cash. The ACH processing piece, which integrates into that point of sale as well, right? So if you think of the point of sale as the way they're getting money in the door, and then the bank being the, you know, we playing that bank role, helping to facilitate all that, it's such a natural fit of bringing that solution into our dispensary and delivery customers that need those type of solutions.
I'm going to throw out a prompt in very AI kind of style nowadays. Sure. And it's related to the question, and it's a prompt: AI, blockchain, crypto. Mm-hmm. Ramble a little bit, like, what kind of integration do you see here for Dama and for the entire industry?
You know, well, we're already using some AI support and help on the quality control and testing of our code. So very innovative CTO we have that's brought that to bear to try to streamline and improve the efficiencies associated with deployment of quality software. So that's number one. I think number two, which will be very big, is using some of that AI in the compliance and the transaction monitoring, right? So that you can be on top of and not have to do so much maybe manual work to identify what are some transactions that might cause some extra concern that we need to highlight and maybe even report on or at least investigate further. Maybe it doesn't go so far as to require a SARS reporting, but it might go far enough that we at least want to look into it and understand. So that ability to streamline and take the heavy lifting out of compliance, I think, is an area where AI could really help. And, you know, not, and we're hearing, I haven't seen as much of it yet myself, but, you know, on the blockchain side, we've got to figure out this consumer payments piece, right? We've just got to. It's too much change. It's too difficult. Yes, we're always there and able to work with smart safes and the cash side of the business. But as your last guest would have probably told you, cash is a tough way to do business, right? There's a lot of theft. There's a lot of inefficiencies associated with it. Yeah. So yes, we have the solutions to help in that area. But that third rail of cannabis, the consumer payments, and trying to make it more like when you walk into, not to use another brand, but a Quick Trip or a 7-Eleven, and you can just pay for your goods and walk out, right? That's the key. And fortunately, I had a little turn of events a couple of few weeks ago by the association. So it's kind of back to the drawing board a little bit there. But I've heard and I believe that potentially some blockchain type solutions might be able to help there.
Interesting. Well, we'll see what happens next. This is like, you know, getting a little bit personal, but, you know, you look younger than you are. So you have a lengthy career in finance, in payments, in fintech. You know, if you had to reflect a little bit and think of a pivotal moment in your career that prepared you for your role as CEO of Dama Financial, can you pinpoint one foundational moment?
Yeah, I'd say when I started a payments accounts receivable company back in early 2000, right? And it's kind of what we try to do today. You know, payments acceptance was pretty regular out there, but trying to identify the pains businesses have, right? And then what can you do to address and help them in those pains? I think is so critical to get into, again, that operational efficiency that is needed in this industry, in an industry that every piece of efficiency matters because it's so costly to operate in this industry. So that approach of constantly saying, what is our customer's biggest pains? And now what tools do we have? What solutions do we have? What support and services do we have that can help reduce those pains so they can do what's most important to them, whether they be a grower and they're focused on growing, whether they be a manufacturer and they need to manufacture and package product, distribute, and or the end dispensary. They're most concerned about that customer and that customer experience. How can we help them make that a more operationally sound solution set for them? That's what we try to be, is that business service provider. And so starting that first company really helped me to listen to the customer, understand their issue, and then see how we can help address it.
Efficient payments are, of course, one element to bringing cannabis really to the mainstream and turning it into a CPG product.
Yeah.
If you had to pick one more element that would or could define the path of cannabis toward the mainstream, what do you think that is?
Well, again, you got to remember, I'm always thinking from a business supporting their business, right? Not so much the consumer side of it, but, you know, access to lending, access to just traditional lending, and in a way that is not onerous, meaning too costly. It's something we are looking at. We're looking to partner with a few individuals, few businesses to help provide those type of services. I think it's important. Every business needs, you know, some working capital that isn't necessarily having to go out and do a raise again, right? Which is very distracting, right? Just be able to go get a normal loan at a good rate and use it for, you know, just running your daily business, buying your products so you can stay ahead of your competition. So I think that lending piece is a key aspect on top of that consumer payments to try to make businesses be able to weather the flow and the cycle of their normal business cycle.
Would you dare giving us your timeline of when you think this could happen and what needs to happen on the legislative front, if anything, for, you know, reasonable, let's call it, lending practices and access to lending in the cannabis space?
So first, from Dama's perspective, my goal is sometime late Q4, worst case, early Q1, to have solutions out there that are unique and differentiating in the space. What has to happen regulatory-wise is, again, we know it's not perfect, but safe banking has to come around, right? More banks have to be in this space. You know, some people think there was some thought that, well, is Dama needed in that situation? Well, again, the regulatory pieces are still going to be there. The complexity is still there. The knowledge of the industry is still there. And banks are, I truly believe, looking for a partner. And I've seen that. The number of banks that want to talk to understand how they can get involved but mitigate their risk. Nothing's going to change there with SAFE on that regard. It'd just be more banks getting involved. And more banks getting involved is a good thing for the entire industry.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that really is the first step. It's not the only step. There's many other things that need to happen. You know, rescheduling, very important, right? I mean, there's so many other things that have to happen. You know, and unfortunately, we'll have to wait to see what happens up on the Hill.
Fingers crossed, man. We're way over time. I got carried away with our interviews today, but like, anything you want to leave our, there you go. That's my reminder. Anything you want to leave our viewers or our listeners with in relation to yourself, to Dama, or the future of the industry?
Well, anxious to see everyone up at Bazinga here in about a month, right? About a month from now. We'll have a little fireside. We're going to host a little networking event. So look for more details on that. And just looking forward to seeing everyone and spending some time.
Well, y'all know, if you're listening to this, if you're watching now live, if you're listening later on Spotify or an Apple Podcast, whatever it is, come meet Patrick, come meet other visionaries in the cannabis space. People really pushing this industry forward at the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference, bccannabis.com, September 27 and 28. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sitting through my plug right now, and we'll see you in Chicago.
Thank you, Xavier. Great, great job.
Thanks. This was fun. Another show, another Tuesday. We'll see you again next Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. If you're in Argentina, it's like 2 p.m. I don't know where you're listening in from. Tell us in the comments. And next time I will make sure to mention your time zone until Thursday. By the way, again, one last reminder, bzcannabis.com. Come join us in Chicago. And bzinga.com/cannabis for your daily dose of cannabis news. My name is Javier Acase. Go follow me on social if you so feel inclined to it. And that's it for today. It's a wrap. Peace.